and together they spent the night lauding Burnham, prematurely, for achieving the impossible. Of course, they ate like gods. The menu? Blue points à l'Alaska. Sauterne. Potage. Consommé printanier. Crème de céleri. Amontillado. Hors d'oeuvres. Rissole Chateaubriand. Amande salée. Olives, etc. Poisson. Basse riée. Sauce hollandaise. Pomme parisienne. Meersfeiner. Mouet et Chandon. Perrier Juif. Extra dry special. Ruffev. Filet de bœuf au champignon. Haricot vert. Pomme duchesse. Entrée. Riz de veau en côtelette. Petit pois. Sorbet. Romaine, fantaisie, cigarettes. Rôti. Canard de tête rouge. Salade de lettuce. Ponté canné. Dessert. Petit moule fantaisie. Gâteau assorti. Bonbons. Petit four. Fruit assorti. Fromage. Roquefort à camembert. Café. Apollinari. Cognac. Cordials, cigars. Newspapers reported that Olmsted also was present, but in fact he was in Asheville, North Carolina, continuing his work on Vanderbilt's estate. His absence prompted speculation that he had stayed away out of pique at not being invited to share the podium, and because the invitation had identified the major arts only as painting, architecture, and sculpture, with no reference to landscape architecture. While it is true that Olmsted had struggled throughout his career to build respect for landscape architecture as a distinct branch of the fine arts, for him to shun the banquet because of hurt feelings would have been out of character. The simplest explanation seems best. Olmsted was ill, his work everywhere was behind schedule, he disliked ceremonies, and above all, he loathed long-distance train travel, especially in transitional months when rail cars, even the finest Pullman palaces were likely to be too hot or too cold. Had he attended, he would have heard Burnham tell the guests, "Each of you knows the name and genius of him who stands first in the heart and confidence of American artists, the creator of your own and many other city parks. He it is who has been our best advisor and our constant mentor. In the highest sense, he is the planner of the exposition." Frederick Law Olmsted. An artist, he paints with lakes and wooded slopes, with lawns and banks and forest-covered hills, with mountainsides and ocean views. He should stand where I do tonight. Which is not to say that Burnham wanted to sit down. He reveled in the attention and adored the engraved silver loving cup that was filled with wine and held to the lips of every man at the table. Despite the prevalence in the city outside of typhoid, diphtheria, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. He knew the praise was premature, but the banquet hinted at the greater glory that would accrue to him at fair's end, provided, of course, the exposition met the world's elaborate expectations. Without doubt, huge progress had been made. The six grandest buildings of the exposition towered over the central basin with an effect more dramatic and imposing than even he had imagined. Daniel Chester French's Statue of the Republic, nicknamed Big Mary, stood in the basin complete and gleaming, its entire surface gilded. Including plinth, the Republic was 111 feet tall. Over 200 other buildings erected by states, corporations, and foreign governments stippled the surrounding acreage. The White Star Line had built a charming little temple at the northwest bank of the lagoon opposite the wooded island, with steps to the water. The monstrous guns of Krupp were in place in their pavilion on the lake south of the Court of Honor. "The scale of the whole thing is more and more tremendous as the work proceeds," McKim wrote to Richard Hunt. a bit too tremendous, he noted cattily, at least in the case of the manufacturer's building. His own agriculture building, he wrote, must suffer by comparison with its huge neighbor opposite, whose volume, 215 feet high, off the main axis, is bound to swamp us and everything else around it. He told Hunt he had just spent 2 days with Burnham, including 2 nights at the shanty. He is keeping up under his responsibilities and looking well, and we all owe him a great debt for his constant watchfulness and attention to our slightest wishes. Even the carpenter's strike did not trouble Burnham. There seemed to be plenty of unemployed, non-union carpenters willing to step in for the absent strikers. I fear nothing at all from this source, he wrote on April 6th in a letter to Margaret. The day was cold, but clear, bright, and beautiful, a splendid day to live and work in. Workers were putting in the embellishments, he wrote. A lot of ducks were put in the lagoons yesterday, and they are floating around contentedly and quite like life this morning. Olmsted had ordered over 800 ducks and geese and 7,000 pigeons, and for the sake of accent, a number of exotic birds, including 4 snowy egrets, 4 storks, 2 brown pelicans, and 2 flamingos. So far, only the common white ducks had been introduced into the waters. In 2 or 3 days, Burnham wrote, all the birds will be in the water, which already commences to be still more beautiful than last year. The weather remained lovely, crisp, clear, and dry. On Monday, April 10th, he told Margaret, I am very happy. Over the next few days, his mood changed. There was talk that other unions might join the carpenter's strike and bring all work in Jackson Park to a halt. Suddenly, the exposition seemed dangerously far from ready. Construction of the sheds for the stock exhibits at the south end of the grounds had yet to begin. Everywhere Burnham looked, he saw rail tracks and temporary roads, empty boxcars and packing crates. Tumbleweeds of excelsior roved the grounds. He was disappointed with the unfinished appearance of the park, and he was peeved at his wife. "Why do you not write me every day?" he asked on Thursday. "I look in vain for your letters." He kept a photograph of Margaret in his office. Every time he walked by it, he picked it up and stared at it with longing. So far that day, he told her, he had looked at it 10 times. He had counted on a rest after May 1st, but realized now that the intensity would persist until long afterward. The public will regard the work as entirely done, and I wish it were so, far as I am concerned. I presume anyone running a race has moments of half-despair along toward the end, but they must never be yielded to. Margaret sent him a 4-leafed clover. There was disarray in the fairgrounds, but not next door on the 15 acres of ground leased by Buffalo Bill for his show, which now bore the official title, Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World. He was able to open his show on April 3rd and immediately filled his 18,000-seat arena. Visitors entered through a gate that featured Columbus on one side under the banner Pilot of the Ocean, the first pioneer, and Buffalo Bill on the other, identified as Pilot of the Prairie, the last pioneer. His show and camp covered 15 acres. Its hundreds of Indians, soldiers, and workers slept in tents. Annie Oakley always made hers very homey, with a garden outside of primrose, geranium, and hollyhock. Inside, she placed her couch, cougar skins, an Axminster carpet, rocking chairs, and assorted other artifacts of domestic life. And, of course, a diverse collection of guns. Buffalo Bill always began his show with his cowboy band playing the Star-Spangled Banner. Next came the Grand Review, during which soldiers from America, England, France, Germany, and Russia paraded on horseback around his arena. Annie Oakley came next, blasting away at an array of impossible targets. She hit them. Another of the show's staples was an Indian attack on an old stagecoach, the Deadwood Mail coach, with Buffalo Bill and his men coming to the rescue. During the show's earlier engagement in London, the Indians attacked the coach as it raced across the grounds of Windsor Castle, carrying four kings and the Prince of Wales. Buffalo Bill drove. Late in the program, Cody himself demonstrated some fancy marksmanship, dashing around the arena on horseback while firing his Winchester at glass balls hurled into the air by his assistants. The climax of the show was the attack on a settler's cabin, during which Indians who once had slaughtered soldiers and civilians alike staged a mock attack on a cabin full of white settlers, only to be vanquished yet again by Buffalo Bill and a company of cowboys firing blanks. As the season advanced, Cody replaced the attack with the even more dramatic Battle of the Little Bighorn, showing with historical accuracy the scene of Custer's last charge. The fair was hard on Colonel Cody's marriage. The show always kept him away from his home in North Platte, Nebraska, but his absence wasn't the main problem. Bill liked women, and women liked Bill. One day his wife Louisa, Lulu, traveled to Chicago for a surprise conjugal visit. She found that Bill's wife already had arrived. At the hotel's front desk, a clerk told her she would now be escorted up to Mr. and Mrs. Cody's suite. Fearful that a wider strike could hobble the fair, even destroy it, Burnham began negotiations with the carpenters and ironworkers and agreed at last to establish a minimum wage and to pay time and a half for extra hours, double time for Sundays and key holidays, including, significantly, Labor Day. The union men in turn signed a contract to work until the end of the fair. Burnham's clear relief suggests that his earlier bravado might have been just for show. "You can imagine, though tired, I go to bed happy," he wrote to his wife. One measure of his exhaustion was the fact that the contorted syntax he usually worked so hard to suppress had now resurfaced. "We sat from early in the afternoon to 9 o'clock. Till the fair is over, this trial will not recur, I believe, so your picture before me is unusually lovely as it looks up from the desk." Burnham claimed the agreement was a victory for the exposition, but in fact the fair's concessions were a breakthrough for organized labor, and the resulting contracts became models for other unions to emulate. The fair's capitulation pumped steam into America's and Chicago's already boiling labor movement. Olmsted returned to Chicago accompanied by his usual troika of affliction and found the place galvanized, Burnham everywhere at once. On Thursday, April 13th, Olmsted wrote to his son John, "Everybody here in a keen rush, the greatest in imaginable outward confusion." Winds raced over the park's barren stretches and raised blizzards of dust. Train after train arrived bearing exhibits that should have been installed long before. The delayed installations meant that temporary tracks and roads had to remain in place. 2 days later, Olmsted wrote, "We shall have to bear the blame of everyone else's tardiness, as their operations are now everywhere in our way. At best, the most important part of all our work will have to be done at night after the opening of the exposition. I cannot see any way through the confusion, but there are thousands of men at work under various chiefs, and I suppose by and by the great labor will begin to tell together." He assigned some of the blame for the incomplete landscape to himself for failing to install a trustworthy overseer in Chicago after the death of Harry Codman. On April 15, 1893, he wrote to his son John, "I am afraid that we were wrong in leaving the business so much to Ulrich and Phil. Ulrich is not, I hope, intentionally dishonest, but he is perverse to the point of deceiving and misleading us and cannot be depended on. His energy is largely exhausted on matters that he should not be concerned with. I cannot trust him from day to day." His frustration with Ulrich grew, his distrust deepened. Later, in another note to John, he said, "Ulrich is unwittingly faithless to us. The difficulty is that he is ambitious of honors out of his proper line, cares more to be more extraordinarily active, industrious, zealous, and generally useful than to achieve fine results in L.A., landscape architecture." Olmsted grew especially leery of Ulrich's slavish attentiveness to Burnham. He is all over the grounds, about all sorts of business, and Mr. Burnham and every head of department is constantly calling for Ulrich. In going over the works with Burnham, I find him constantly repeating to his secretary, "Tell Ulrich to do this and that." I remonstrate, but it does little good. I can never find him at the work except by special appointment, and then he is impatient to get away. At heart, what Olmsted feared was that Burnham had transferred his loyalty to Ulrich. I suppose that our time is out. Our engagement ended, and I fear that Burnham is disposed to let us go and depend on Ulrich. For Burnham is not competent to see the incompetency of Ulrich and the need of deliberate thought. I have to be cautious not to bore Burnham, who is, of course, enormously overloaded. Other obstacles quickly appeared. An important shipment of plants from California failed to arrive, worsening an already critical shortage of all plants. Even the fine weather that prevailed in the first couple of weeks of April caused delays. The lack of rain and the fact the park's waterworks were not yet completed meant Olmsted could not plant exposed portions of the grounds. The wind-blown dust, frightful dust, he said, regular sandstorms of the desert, continued and stung his eyes and propelled grit into his inflamed mouth. "I am trying to suggest why I seem to be accomplishing so little," he wrote. "I think the public for a time will be awfully disappointed with our work. Dissatisfied and a strong hand will be required here for weeks to come to prevent Ulrich's energies from being wrongly directed." By April 21st, Olmsted was again confined to bed, with sore throat, an ulcerating tooth, and much pain preventing sleep. Despite all this, his spirits began slowly to improve. When he looked past the immediate delays and Ulrich's duplicity, he saw progress. The shore of the wooded island was just now beginning to burst forth in a dense profusion of new leaves and blossoms, and the Japanese temple, the huden, crafted in Japan and assembled by Japanese artisans, detracted a little from the sylvan effect. The electric boats had arrived and were lovely, exactly what Olmsted had hoped for, and the waterfowl on the lagoons provided enchanting sparks of energy in counterpoint to the static white immensity of the Court of Honor. Olmsted recognized that Burnham's forces could not possibly finish patching and painting by May 1st, and that his own work would be far from complete, but he saw clear improvement. "A larger force is employed," he wrote, "and every day's work tells." Even this flicker of optimism was about to disappear, however, for a powerful weather front was moving across the prairie toward Chicago. During this period, the exact date unclear, a milk peddler named Joseph McCarthy stopped his cart near Chicago's Humboldt Park. It was morning, about 11 o'clock. A man in the park had caught his attention. He realized he knew the man. Patrick Prendergast, a newspaper distributor employed by the Interocean. The odd thing was, Prendergast was walking in circles. Odder still, he walked with his head tipped back and his hat pulled so low it covered his eyes. As McCarthy watched, Prendergast walked face first into a tree. Rain began to fall. At first, it did not trouble Burnham. It suppressed the dust that rose from the unplanted portions of the grounds, of which he was disappointed to see there were far too many, and by now all the roofs were finished, even the roof of the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building. "It rains," Burnham wrote to Margaret on Tuesday, April 18th, "and for the first time I say let it. My roofs are in such good order at last. As to leaks, we care little." But the rain continued and grew heavier. At night it fell past the electric lights in sheets so thick they were nearly opaque. It turned the dust to mud, which caused horses to stagger and wagons to stall. And it found leaks. On Wednesday night, a particularly heavy rain came pounding through Jackson Park and soon a series of 200-foot cataracts began tumbling from the glass ceiling of the manufacturer's building onto the exhibits below. Burnham and an army of workers and guards converged on the building and together spent the night fighting the leaks. "Last night turned out the most terrible storm we have had in Jackson Park," Burnham wrote Margaret on Thursday. No damage was done to the buildings on grounds except that the roofs of the manufacturer's building leaked on the east side, and we stayed there until midnight, covering up goods. One of the papers says that General Davis was on hand and attending to things, and that he never left the building till all was safe. Of course, Mr. D. had nothing whatever to do with it. The rain seemed to bring into focus just how much work remained. That same Thursday, Burnham wrote another letter to Margaret. "The weather is very bad here and has so continued since last Tuesday, but I keep right along, although the most gigantic work lies before us. The intensity of this last month is very great indeed. You can little imagine it. I am surprised at my own calmness under it all." But the challenge, he said, had tested his lieutenants. "The strain on them shows who is made of good metal and who is not. I can tell you that very few come right up to the mark under these conditions, but there are some who can be depended on. The rest have to be pounded every hour of the day, and they are the ones who make me tired." As always, he longed for Margaret. She was out of the city, but due back for the opening. "I will be on the lookout for you, my dear girl," he wrote. "You must expect to give yourself up when you come." For this buttoned-up age, for Burnham, it was a letter that could have steamed itself open. Day after day, the same thing. Fogged windows, paper curled from ambient moisture, the demonic applause of rain on rooftops, and everywhere the stench of sweat and moist wool, especially in the workers' mess at lunch hour. Rain filled electrical conduits and shorted circuits. At the Ferris wheel, the pumps meant to drain the tower excavations ran 24 hours, but could not conquer the volume of water. Rain poured through the ceiling of the woman's building and halted the installation of exhibits. In the midway, the Egyptians and Algerians and half-clothed Dahomans suffered. Only the Irish, in Mrs. Hart's Irish village, seemed to take it in stride. For Olmsted, the rain was particularly disheartening. It fell on ground already saturated and filled every dip in every path. Puddles became lakes. The wheels of heavily loaded wagons sank deep into the mud and left gaping lacerations, adding to the list of wounds to be filled, smoothed, and sodded. Despite the rain, the pace of work increased. Olmsted was awed by the sheer numbers of workers involved. On April 27th, 3 days before the opening, he reported to his firm, "I wrote you that there were 2,000 men employed." Foolishly. "There have been 2,000 men employed directly by Mr. Burnham. This week there are more than twice that number, exclusive of contractors' forces. Including contractors and concessionaires' forces, there are now 10,000 men at work on the ground, and would be more if more of certain classes could be obtained. Our work is badly delayed because teams cannot be hired in sufficient numbers." His estimate was low. In those closing weeks, the total number of workers in the park was almost 20,000. He was still desperately short of plants, he complained. "All resources for these seem to have failed, and the want of them will be serious in its result." His ulcerated tooth, at least, had improved, and he was no longer confined to bed. "My ulcer has shrunk," he wrote. "I still have to live on bread and milk, but am going about in the rain today and getting better." That same day, however, he wrote John a private and far bleaker letter. "We are having bad luck. Heavy rain again today." Burnham was pressuring him to take all manner of shortcuts to get the Court of Honor into presentable shape, such as having his men fill pots with rhododendrons and palms to decorate terraces, precisely the kind of showy, transient measures that Olmsted disdained. "I don't like it at all," he wrote. He resented having to resort to temporary expedients merely to make a poor show for the opening. He knew that immediately after the opening all such work would have to be redone. His ailments, his frustration, and the mounting intensity of the work taxed his spirits and caused him to feel older than his age. The diet of the provisional mess table, the noise and scurry and the puddles and rain do not leave a dilapidated old man much comfort, and my throat and mouth are still in such condition that I have to keep slopping victuals. He did not give up, however. Despite the rain, he jolted around the grounds to direct planting and sodding, and every morning at dawn attended Burnham's mandatory muster of key men. The exertion and weather reversed the improvement in his health. "I took cold and was up all night with bone trouble and am living on toast and tea," he wrote on Friday, April 28th. "Nearly constant heavy rain all the day, checking our work sadly." Yet the frenzy of preparations for Monday's opening continued unabated. "It is queer to see the painters at work on ladders and scaffolds in this heavy rain," Olmsted wrote. "Many are completely drenched, and I should think their painting must be streaky." He noticed that the big Columbia fountain at the western end of the central basin still was not finished, even though it was to be a key feature of the opening ceremony. A test was scheduled for the following day, Saturday. "It does not look ready by any means," Olmsted wrote, "but it is expected that it will play before the president next Monday." As for the work under his own department, Olmsted was disappointed. He had hoped to accomplish far more by now. He knew also that others shared his disappointment. "I get wind of much misplaced criticism by men as clever even as Burnham because of impressions from incomplete work and undeveloped compositions," he wrote. He knew that in many places the grounds did look sparse and unkempt, and that much work remained. Anyone could see the gaps. But to hear about it from others, especially from a man whom he admired and respected, was profoundly depressing. The deadline was immutable. Too much had been set in motion for anyone even to consider postponement. The opening ceremony was scheduled to begin, would begin, on Monday morning with a parade from the Loop to Jackson Park, led by the new President of the United States, Grover Cleveland. Train after train now entered Chicago, bringing statesmen, princes, and tycoons from all over the world. President Cleveland arrived with his vice president and a retinue of cabinet officials, senators and military leaders, and their wives, children, and friends. The rain steamed off black locomotives. Porters hauled great trunks from the baggage cars. Caravans of water-slicked black carriages lined the streets outside the city's train stations, their red waiting lights haloed by the rain. The hours slipped past. On the evening of April 30th, the night before opening day, a British reporter named F. Herbert Stead visited the fairgrounds. The name Stead was well known in America because of Herbert's more famous brother, William, the former editor of London's Pall Mall Gazette and recent founder of the Review of Reviews. Assigned to cover the opening ceremony, Herbert decided to scout the grounds ahead of time to get a more detailed sense of the fair's topography. It was raining hard when he exited his carriage and entered Jackson Park. Lights blazed everywhere as shawls of rain unfurled around them. The ponds that had replaced Olmsted's elegant paths shuddered under the impact of a billion falling droplets. Hundreds of empty freight cars stood black against the lights. Lumber and empty crates and the remains of workers' lunches lay everywhere. The whole scene was heartbreaking, but also perplexing. The fair's opening day celebration was set to begin the next morning, yet the grounds were clotted with litter and debris. "In a state," Stead wrote, "of gross incompleteness." The rain continued through the night. Later that Sunday night, as rain thumped their windowsills, editors of Chicago's morning dailies laid out bold and elaborate headlines for Monday's historic editions. Not since the Chicago Fire of 1871 had the city's newspapers been so galvanized by a single event. But there was more quotidian work to be done as well. The more junior typesetters leaded and shimmed the classifieds and personals and all the other advertisements that filled the inside pages. Some that night worked on a small notice announcing the opening of a new hotel. Clearly another hastily built affair meant to capitalize on the expected crush of exposition visitors. This hotel at least seemed to be well located. At 63rd and Wallace in Englewood, a short ride on the new Alley L from the fair's 64th Street gate. The owner called it the World's Fair Hotel. Part 3. In the White City, May to October, 1893. Opening Day. 23 gleaming black carriages stood in the yellow mud of Michigan Avenue in front of the Lexington Hotel. President Cleveland boarded the 7th carriage, a landau. Burnham and Davis shared the 6th. Both men behaved, although they still had not shed their mutual distrust, nor resolved their struggle for supreme control of the fair. The Duke of Veragua, the last living descendant of Columbus, sat in the 14th carriage. The Duchess occupied the 15th with Bertha Palmer, whose diamonds radiated an almost palpable heat. Mayor Harrison took the very last carriage and drew the loudest cheers. Assorted other dignitaries filled the remaining carriages. As the procession rumbled south along Michigan Avenue toward Jackson Park, the street behind became a following sea of 200,000 Chicagoans on foot and horseback, in phaetons, victorias, and stanhopes, and packed into omnibuses and streetcars. Many thousands of others boarded trains and jammed the bright yellow cars dubbed cattle cars, built by the Illinois Central to haul as many people as possible to the fair. Anyone with a white handkerchief waved it, and white flags hung from every lamppost. Damp bunting swelled from building facades. 1,500 members of the Columbian Guard in their new uniforms of light blue sackcloth, white gloves, and yellow-lined black capes met the throng and cordially directed everyone to the administration building, recognizable by its lofty gold dome. The procession approached the fair from the west through the Midway Plaisance. Just as the president's carriage turned into the Avenue of Nations, which ran the 13-block length of the Midway, the sun emerged, igniting a roar of approval from spectators as it lit the 40 concessions that lined the avenue, some the size of small towns. The carriages rolled past Sitting Bull's Cabin, the Lapland Village, the compound of the allegedly cannibalistic Dahomans, and, directly opposite, the California Ostrich Farm, redolent of simmering butter and eggs. The farm offered omelets made from ostrich eggs, though in fact the eggs came from domestic chickens. The procession passed the Austrian Village and Captive Balloon Park, where a hydrogen balloon tethered to the ground took visitors aloft. At the center of the midway, the procession veered around the woefully incomplete Ferris wheel, which Burnham eyed with displeasure. It was a half-moon of steel encased in a skyscraper of wooden falsework. When President Cleveland's carriage came to Saul Bloom's Algerian village at the Muslim core of the Midway, Bloom gave a nod, and the women of the village dropped their veils. Bloom swore it was a customary gesture of respect, but of course with Bloom one could never be sure. The carriages skirted the street in Cairo, not yet open, another disappointment, and passed the Turkish village and the Java lunchroom. Outside Hagenbach's animal show, the most famous traveling zoo of the day, handlers prodded 4 trained lions into full roar. To the right, in the smoky distance, the president saw the banners of Buffalo Bill's Wild West flying over the arena Colonel Cody had built at 62nd Street. At last, the carriages entered Jackson Park. There would be miracles at the fair. The chocolate Venus de Milo would not melt. The 22,000-pound cheese in the Wisconsin Pavilion would not mold. But the greatest miracle was the transformation of the grounds during the long, soggy night that had preceded Cleveland's arrival. When Herbert Stead returned the next morning, a plain of wind-rippled water still covered portions of the park, but the empty boxcars and packing debris were gone. 10,000 men working through the night had touched up the paint and staff and planted pansies and laid sod as 1,000 scrubwomen washed, waxed, and polished the floors of the great buildings. As the morning advanced, the sun emerged more fully. In the bright, rain-scrubbed air, those portions of the landscape not still submerged looked cheerful, trim, and neat. When the fair opened, said Paul Sterrett, one of Burnham's men, Olmsted's lawns were the first amazement. At 11 o'clock, President Cleveland ascended the stairs to the speaker's platform erected outside the east end of the administration building and took his seat, the signal for the ceremony to begin. The crowd surged forward. 20 women fainted. Reporters lucky enough to be in the front rows rescued one elderly woman by hauling her over a railing and laying her out on a press table. Members of the guard waded in with swords drawn. Mayhem reigned until Director General Davis signaled the orchestra to begin playing the introductory Columbian March. Chastened by criticism of the stupefying length of October's dedication ceremony, the fair's officers had kept the opening day program short and pledged to honor the timetable at all costs. First came a blessing given by a blind chaplain to an audience made deaf by size and distance. Next came a poetic ode to Columbus as long and difficult to endure as the Admiral's voyage itself. Then from the Pinta's foretop fell a cry, a trumpet song, light ho, light ho, light. That kind of thing. Director General Davis spoke next and offered a meaty helping of distorted reality, praising the way the National Commission, the Exposition Company, and the Board of Lady Managers had worked together without strife to produce such a brilliant exposition. Those privy to the warfare within and between these agencies watched Burnham closely, but saw no change in his expression. Davis offered the podium to the president. Cleveland, immense in black, a human locomotive, paused a moment in sober examination of the crowd before him. Nearby stood a table draped in an American flag, on top of which lay a blue and red velvet pillow, supporting a telegraph key made of gold. Every bit of terrace, lawn, and railing in the Court of Honor was occupied. The men in black and gray, many of the women in gowns of extravagant hues, violet, scarlet, emerald, and wearing hats with ribbons, sprigs, and feathers. A tall man in a huge white hat and a white buckskin coat heavily trimmed in silver stood a full head above the man around him. Buffalo Bill. Women watched him. Sunlight fell between tufts of fast-shredding cloud and lit the white panamas that flecked the audience. From the president's vantage point, the scene was festive and crisp, but at ground level, there was water and mud and the sucking sound made whenever anyone shifted position. The only human form with dry feet was that of Daniel Chester French's The Republic, Big Mary, which stood hidden under a silo of canvas. Cleveland's speech was the shortest of all. As he concluded, he moved to the flag-draped table. As by a touch, the machinery that gives light to this vast exposition is set in motion, he said, so at the same instant let our hopes and aspirations awaken forces which in all time to come shall influence the welfare, the dignity, and the freedom of mankind. At precisely 12:08, he touched the gold key. A roar radiated outward as successive strata of the crowd learned the key had been pressed. Workmen on rooftops immediately signaled to piers stationed throughout the park and to sailors aboard the warship Michigan anchored in the lake. The key closed an electric circuit which activated the electromagnetic engine stop and starter attached to the giant 3,000-horsepower Alice steam engine at Machinery Hall. The starter's silver-plated gong rang, a sprocket turned, a valve opened, and the engine whooshed to life on exquisitely machined shafts and bearings. Immediately, 30 other engines in the building began to thrum. At the Fair's waterworks, 3 huge Worthington pumps began stretching their shafts and pistons, like praying mantises shaking off the cold. Millions of gallons of water began surging through the Fair's mains. Engines everywhere took steam until the ground trembled. An American flag the size of a mainsail unfurled from the tallest flagpole in the Court of Honor, and immediately 2 more like-sized flags tumbled from flanking poles, one representing Spain, the other Columbus. Water pressurized by the Worthington pumps exploded from the McMonnies fountain and soared 100 feet into the sky, casting a sheet rainbow across the sun and driving visitors to raise their umbrellas against the spray. Banners and flags and gonfalons suddenly bellied from every cornice. A huge red banner unscrolled along the full length of the machinery hall, and the canvas slipped from Big Mary's gold-leaf shoulders. Sunlight clattering from her skin caused men and women to shield their eyes. 200 white doves leapt for the sky. The guns of the Michigan fired. Steam whistles shrieked. Spontaneously, the throng began to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, which many thought of as the national anthem, although no song had yet received that designation. As the crowd thundered, a man eased up beside a thin, pale woman with a bent neck. In the next instant, Jane Addams realized her purse was gone. The Great Fair had begun. Although Burnham recognized that much work lay ahead, that Olmsted had to redouble his efforts and Ferris needed to finish that damned wheel, the success of the exposition now seemed assured. Congratulations arrived by telegraph and post. A friend told Burnham, "The scene burst on me with the beauty of a full-blown rose." The official history of the fair estimated that 250,000 people packed Jackson Park on opening day. 2 other estimates put the total at 500,000 and 620,000. By day's end, there was every indication that Chicago's fair would become the most heavily attended entertainment in the history of the world. This optimism lasted all of 24 hours. On Tuesday, May 2nd, only 10,000 people came to Jackson Park, a rate of attendance that, if continued, would guarantee the fair a place in history as one of the greatest failures of all time. The yellow cattle cars were mostly empty, as were the cars of the Alley L that ran along 63rd Street. All hope that this was merely an anomaly disappeared the next day when the forces that had been battering the nation's economy erupted in a panic on Wall Street that caused stock prices to plummet. And this was only the beginning. On the night of Thursday, May 5th, officials of the National Cordage Company, a trust that controlled 80% of America's rope production, placed itself in receivership. Next, Chicago's Chemical National Bank ceased operation, a closure that seemed particularly ominous to fair officials because Chemical alone had won congressional approval to open a branch at the World's Fair in no less central a location than the administration building. 3 days later, another large Chicago bank failed, and soon after that, a third, the Evanston National Bank in Burnham's town. Dozens of other failures occurred around the country. In Brunswick, Georgia, the presidents of 2 national banks held a meeting. One president calmly excused himself, entered his private office, and shot himself through the head. Both banks failed. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the Nebraska Savings Bank had become the favorite bank of school children. The town's teachers served as agents of the bank and every week collected money from the children for deposit in each child's passbook account. Word that the bank was near failure caused the street out front to fill with children pleading for their money. Other banks came to Nebraska Savings Rescue, and the so-called children's run was quelled. People who otherwise might have traveled to Chicago to see the fair now stayed home. The terrifying economy was discouraging enough, but so too were reports of the unfinished character of the fair. If people had only one chance to go, they wanted to do it when all the exhibits were in place and every attraction was in operation, especially the Ferris wheel, said to be a marvel of engineering that would make the Eiffel Tower seem like a child's sculpture. Provided it ever actually worked and did not collapse in the first brisk wind. Too many features of the fair remained unfinished, Burnham acknowledged. He and his brigade of architects, draftsmen, engineers, and contractors had accomplished so much in an impossibly short time, but apparently not enough to overcome the damping effect of a fast, degrading economy. The elevators in the manufacturer's building, touted as one of the wonders of the fair, still had not begun operation. The Ferris wheel looked only half-finished. Olmsted had yet to complete grading and planting the grounds around the Krupp Pavilion, the leather building, and the cold storage building. He had not yet laid the brick pavement at the fair's train station or sodded the New York Central exhibit, the Pennsylvania Railroad exhibit, Coral Hall, and the Illinois State Building, which to many Chicagoans was the single most important building at the fair. The installation of exhibits and company pavilions within the electricity building was woefully behind schedule. Westinghouse only began building his pavilion on Tuesday, May 2nd. Burnham issued stern directives to Olmsted and Ferris, and every contractor still at work. Olmsted in particular felt the pressure, but also felt hobbled by the persistent delays in installation of exhibits and the damage done by the repeated comings and goings of drays and freight cars. General Electric alone had 15 carloads of exhibit materials stored on the grounds. Preparations for the opening day ceremony had cost Olmsted's department valuable time, as did the planting and grading required to repair the damage the day's crowd had inflicted throughout the park. Many of the fair's 57 miles of roadway were still either submerged or coated with mud, and others had been gouged and trenched by vehicles that had used the roads while they were still sodden. Olmsted's road contractor deployed a force of 800 men and 100 teams to begin regrading the roads and laying new gravel. "I remain fairly well," Olmsted wrote to his son on May 15th, "but get horribly tired every day. It is hard to get things done. My body is so overworked, and I constantly fail to accomplish what I expect to do." First and foremost, Burnham knew, the fair had to be finished. But in the meantime, lures had to be cast to encourage people to shed their fears of financial ruin and come to Chicago. He created the new post of Director of Functions and assigned Frank Millett to the job, giving him wide latitude to do what he could to boost attendance. Millett orchestrated fireworks shows and parades. He set aside special days to honor individual states and nations and to fête distinct groups of workers, including cobblers, millers, confectioners, and stenographers. The Knights of Pythias got their own day, as did the Catholic Knights of America. Millett set August 25th as Colored People Fete Day, and October 9th as Chicago Day. Attendance began to increase, but not by much. By the end of May, the daily average of paying visitors was only 33,000, still far below what Burnham and everyone else had expected, and more to the point, far below the level required to make the fair profitable. Worse yet, Congress and the National Commission, bowing to pressure from the Sabbatarian movement, had ordered the fair closed on Sundays, thus withdrawing its wonders from a few million wage earners for whom Sunday was the only day off. Burnham hoped for an early cure to the nation's financial malaise, but the economy did not oblige. More banks failed, layoffs increased, industrial production sagged, strikes grew more violent. On June 5th, worried depositors staged runs on 8 Chicago banks. Burnham's own firm saw the flow of new commissions come to a halt. A less hospitable time to hold a world's fair was difficult to imagine. The thought that worse might lie ahead occurred to no one. The World's Fair Hotel. The first guests began arriving at Holmes's World's Fair Hotel, though not in the volume he and every other Southside hotelier had expected. The guests were drawn mainly by the hotel's location, with Jackson Park a short trip east on the 63rd Street leg of the Alley L. Even though the rooms on Holmes's second and third floors were largely empty, when male visitors asked about accommodations, Holmes told them, with a look of sincere regret, that he had no vacancies, and kindly referred them to other hotels nearby. His guest rooms began to fill with women, most quite young and apparently unused to living alone. Holmes found them intoxicating. Minnie Williams' continual presence became increasingly awkward. With the arrival of each dewy new guest, she became more jealous, more inclined to stay close to him. Her jealousy did not particularly annoy him. It simply became inconvenient. Minnie was an asset now, an acquisition, to be warehoused until needed, like cocooned prey. Holmes checked newspaper advertisements for a rental flat far enough from his building to make impromptu visits unlikely. He found a place on the north side at 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, a dozen or so blocks west of Lincoln Park, near Halsted. It was a pretty, shaded portion of the city, though its prettiness was to Holmes merely an element to be entered into his calculations. The flat occupied the top floor of a large private house owned by a man named John Oker, whose daughters managed its rental. They first advertised the flat in April 1893. Holmes went alone to examine the apartment and met John Oker. He introduced himself as Henry Gordon and told Oker he was in the real estate business. Oker was impressed with this prospective tenant. He was neat. Maybe fastidious was the better word, and his clothing and behavior suggested financial well-being. Oker was delighted when Henry Gordon said he would take the apartment, even more delighted when Gordon paid him $40 cash in advance. Gordon told Oker he and his wife would arrive in a few weeks. Holmes explained the move to Minnie as a long overdue necessity. Now that they were married, they needed a bigger, nicer place than what they currently occupied in the castle. Soon the building would be bustling with visitors to the fair. Even without the guests, however, it was no place to raise a family. The idea of a large, sunny flat did appeal to Minnie. Truth was, the castle could be gloomy. Was always gloomy. And Minnie wanted everything as perfect as possible for Anna's visit. She was a bit perplexed, however, as to why Harry would choose a place so far away, on the north side, when there were so many lovely homes in Englewood. She reasoned, perhaps, that he did not want to pay the exorbitant rents that everyone was charging, now that the World's Fair was underway. Holmes and Minnie moved into the new flat on June 1, 1893. Laura Oker, the owner's daughter, said Gordon seemed to be very attentive to his wife. The couple went on bicycle rides and for a time kept a hired girl. I can only say that his behavior was all that could be wished during his sojourn with us, Miss Oker said. Minnie Williams he introduced as his wife, and we always addressed her as Mrs. Gordon. She called him Henry. With Minnie housed on Wrightwood Avenue, Holmes found himself free to enjoy his World's Fair Hotel. His guests spent most of their time at Jackson Park or on the Midway, and often did not return until after midnight. While present in the hotel, they tended to stay in their rooms, since Holmes provided none of the common areas, the libraries, game parlors, and writing rooms that the big hotels like the Richelieu and the Metropole and the nearby New Julienne offered as a matter of routine. Nor did he supply the darkroom facilities that hotels closest to Jackson Park had begun installing to serve the growing number of amateur photographers, so-called Kodak fiends, who carried the newest portable cameras. The women found the hotel rather dreary, especially at night, but the presence of its handsome and clearly wealthy owner helped dispel some of its bleakness. Unlike the men they knew back in Minneapolis or Des Moines or Sioux Falls, Holmes was warm and charming and talkative, and touched them with a familiarity that, while perhaps offensive back home, somehow seemed all right in this new world of Chicago. Just another aspect of the great adventure on which these women had embarked. And what good was an adventure if it did not feel a little dangerous? As best anyone could tell, the owner also was a forgiving soul. He did not seem at all concerned when now and then a guest checked out without advance notice, leaving her bills unpaid. That he often smelled vaguely of chemicals, that in fact the building as a whole often had a medicinal odor, bothered no one. He was, after all, a physician, and his building had a pharmacy on the ground floor. Prendergast. Patrick Prendergast believed his appointment as corporation counsel was about to occur. He wanted to be ready and began making plans for how to staff his office once the appointment came through. On May 9, 1893, he got out another of his postcards and addressed it to a man named W.F. Cooling in the Staatszeitung building. Prendergast lectured Cooling on the fact that Jesus was the ultimate legal authority, then gave him the good news. "I am candidate for corporation counsel," he wrote. "If I become corporation counsel, you shall be my assistant." Night is the Magician. Despite its incomplete exhibits, rutted paths, and stretches of unplanted ground, the exposition revealed to its early visitors a vision of what a city could be and ought to be. The black city to the north lay steeped in smoke and garbage, but here in the white city of the fair, visitors found clean public bathrooms, pure water, an ambulance service, electric streetlights, and a sewage processing system that yielded acres of manure for farmers. There was daycare for the children of visitors, and much fun was made of the fact that when you left your child at the children's building, you received a claim check in return. Chicago's small but vocal censorians feared that impoverished parents would turn the building into a depository for unwanted children. Only one child, poor Charlie Johnson, was ever thus abandoned, and not a single child was lost, although anxiety invested the closing moments of each day. Within the fair's buildings, visitors encountered devices and concepts new to them and to the world. They heard live music played by an orchestra in New York and transmitted to the fair by long-distance telephone. They saw the first moving pictures on Edison's kinetoscope and watched, stunned, as lightning chattered from Nikola Tesla's body. They saw even more ungodly things. The first zipper. The first ever all-electric kitchen, which included an automatic dishwasher. And a box purporting to contain everything a cook would need to make pancakes under the brand name Aunt Jemima's. They sampled a new, oddly flavored gum called Juicy Fruit and caramel-coated popcorn called Cracker Jack. A new cereal, Shredded Wheat, seemed unlikely to succeed. Shredded Doormat, some called it. But a new beer did well, winning the exposition's top beer award. Forever afterward, its brewer called it Pabst Blue Ribbon. Visitors also encountered the latest and arguably most important organizational invention of the century, the vertical file, created by Melville Dewey, inventor of the Dewey Decimal System. Sprinkled among these exhibits were novelties of all kinds. A locomotive made of spooled silk, a suspension bridge built out of Kirk's soap, a giant map of the United States made of pickles. Prune makers sent along a full-scale knight on horseback, sculpted out of prunes, and the Avery Salt Mines of Louisiana displayed a copy of the Statue of Liberty carved from a block of salt. Visitors dubbed it Lot's Wife. One of the most compelling and chilling exhibits was the Krupp Pavilion, where Fritz Krupp's pet monster stood at the center of an array of heavy guns. A popular guide to the fair, called the Time Saver, rated every exhibit on a scale of 1 to 3, with 1 being merely interesting and 3 being remarkably interesting, and gave the Krupp Pavilion a 3. For many visitors, however, the weapons were a disturbing presence. Mrs. D. C. Taylor, a frequent visitor to the fair, called Krupp's biggest gun a fearful, hideous thing, breathing of blood and carnage, a triumph of barbarism crouching amid the world's triumphs of civilization. Mrs. Taylor adored the Court of Honor and was struck by the oddly sober manner people adopted as they walked among its palaces. Everyone about us moved softly and spoke gently. No one seemed hurried or impatient. All were under a spell that held us from the opening of the fair until its close. In the midway, she found a very different atmosphere. Here Mrs. Taylor ventured into the street of Cairo, open at last, and witnessed her first belly dance. She watched the dancer carefully. She takes a few light steps to one side, pauses, strikes the castanets, then the same to the other side, advances a few steps, pauses, and causes her abdomen to rise and fall several times in exact time to the music, without moving a muscle in any other part of her body, with incredible rapidity, at the same time holding her head and feet perfectly rigid. As Mrs. Taylor and her companions left the street, she sang quietly to herself, "My country, 'tis of thee," like a frightened child easing past a graveyard. The fair was so big, so beyond grasp, that the Colombian guards found themselves hammered with questions. It was a disease, rhetorical smallpox, and every visitor exhibited it in some degree. The guards answered the same questions over and over, and the questions came fast, often with an accusatory edge. Some questions were just odd. "In which building is the Pope?" one woman asked. She was overheard by writer Teresa Dean, who wrote a daily column from the fair. "The Pope is not here, madam," the guard said. "Where is he?" "In Italy. Europe, madam." The woman frowned. "Which way is that?" Convinced now that the woman was joking, the guard cheerfully quipped, "3 blocks under the lagoon." She said, "How do I get there?" Another visitor, hunting for an exhibit of wax figures, asked a guard, "Can you tell me where the building is that has the artificial human beings?" He began telling her he did not know, when another visitor jumped in. "I have heard of them," he said. "They are over in the women's building. Just ask for the lady managers." One male visitor, who had lost both his legs and made his way around the fair on false limbs and crutches, must have looked particularly knowledgeable, because another visitor peppered him incessantly with questions, until finally the amputee complained that the strain of answering so many questions was wearing him out. "There's just one more thing I'd like to know," his questioner said, "and I'll not trouble ye any more." "Well, what is it?" "I'd like to know how you lost your legs." The amputee said he would answer only on strict condition that this was indeed the last question. He would allow no others. Was that clear? His persecutor agreed. The amputee, fully aware that his answer would raise an immediate corollary question, said they were bit off. Bit off? How? But a deal was a deal. Chuckling, the amputee hobbled away.